Blog Talk Radio.
They even got full thing fell off completely downstairs.
Blog Talk Radio.
Peace be on our honorable and noble listening audience. You're listening once again to another edition of Religion Means Alive. I'm your host, Imam Alfred, the host of Religion Means Alive, and we are very excited. Yesterday we had a few glitches in the program. I was at the graduation of my daughter that graduated from the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, where we had the featured speaker, Reverend John Lewis, the legendary, iconic John Lewis. So our brother, attorney, imam, and professor, Brother Imam Yusuf Salam, Abdul Salam, from Selma, Alabama, is our regular guest, but we had some glitches, so we apologize for that. But we're alive and strong. Tomorrow, I just want to let you know that I will be giving a lecture on culture, and it's important to the development of this new people, the new African. And today, I think it is most appropriate to start our program with an iconic figure, Sister Mariam Ali, the Executive Director of DMTL. Welcome, Sister Mariam Ali, to Religion Means Alive.
Thank you for having me, Brother Ma'am.
And would you please be so kind as to give us an opening statement, tell us whatever you like in your own words, and 2 seconds or less, no, I'm just kidding. Who you are, I mean, what is DMTL? And just anything else you would like to share that you have on your mind and soul.
Oh, well, okay, let's see. Let's see if we can kind of figure this out, my own introduction here. Well, I'm the Executive Director of DMTL. DMTL is a nonprofit organization with a focus in gang prevention services. It's an organization that we're currently raising funds for in order to do a 3-year pilot project in Los Angeles. However, the gang prevention model, our goal is to be able to train on this particular model across the country. So I've been a social worker for about, since 1999, and my concentration has been gang prevention for about 13 years. Most of you may know me as Muhammad Ali's oldest daughter. My father, the boxer, has 9 children. I'm the eldest of the 9, and Layla, the boxer, is the youngest daughter, and then he has an adopted son, Asad Ali, who's graduating college. So we have a whole basketball team. But a lot of people don't know that I've been doing gang prevention work as a profession for many years, and you know, I'm here to talk about anything you want to talk about. I do want to get in with the organizations about, because I am raising funds for that, but I'm pretty much open, whatever you want to ask me, past career, anything like that. But, you know, I just want people to know my main focus is the gang prevention work, and that's what I'm doing right now with gang prevention.
Well, we'll get into some of the other past Mariam Ali's, but I wanted to ask you a question, because we're more motivated by what you are doing. You know, growing up in the South, they used to say, used to bees don't fly anymore. So we're looking for the bees that now fly. Why did you get into gang prevention? Why do you think it's so important to be involved in this line of work? What motivated you to get into it?
Okay, so a lot of things have motivated me. My grandparents, my grandmother, she's had a social worker mentality, and she raised me most of my formative years, and being around her, seeing how she cared for people, that inspired
this
me.
This is your maternal grandmother.
Maternal grandmother, Sister Amina Ali, outside in Chicago.
Oh, very well, and your grandfather, who is a social worker.
Yes, Sajuddin Ali, they're called pioneers in Islam and, you know, in America here, and they were in the nation and they converted over to Islam, and just learned a lot from them. They're good people and always helped people. So their energy of being of service rubbed off on me a great deal. And my father, you know, his humanitarian efforts, how I saw him cater to the African-American community, the less fortunate populations, you know, never forgetting about them, always wanted to be present in the community, no matter how famous he was or how much money he made. He always, you know, made an effort and spent time in the community. So being around him as a young girl, you know, seeing that, it really had a very powerful impression on me in terms of what I should be doing in my life. And I just gravitated towards that work. My father came to me when I was about 8 years old, asking me what was my purpose in life. And I said to him, I want to help people, fix them up, those exact words. And I listened to that tape, and people who hear that tape go, oh, my God, you were into doing that when you were little. So I've had a passion for service since I was a kid. And I think after my first cousin, my mother's sister's son, Otto Ali, was gunned down in South Side of Chicago, in about 1997 or 98, and by gang members, and he wasn't in a gang. His friend, he had a friend who kind of went in that direction, but he was just out getting some food with his friend, and ended up getting in the middle of this gang war and got murdered. And I knew, and that happened when I was in college as a, you know, studying social work. And I knew once I got out of college that I would concentrate on at-risk youth, youth who are very vulnerable to joining gangs or just getting in a life of crime. So that's, you know, all that stuff put together, you know, made me want to get into this field. And the reason why I said I didn't mind talking about my past is that I started rap music trying to be a role model for young people. So in 1992, I had an album out called The Introduction, and the whole album was all about uplifting the younger generation, which, of course, during that time, gang rap was on the rise, and I saw the music industry going really, like, out of control. And I had to make a decision, am I going to try to stay in this industry and, you know, go against the wind and try to be, you know, and make an impact with music, or do I think the music thing is just going down the wrong road? And I decided I didn't think the music industry was going to get any better. I had to make a decision, and therefore I got my degree in social work, and I said I really want to help young people. If it's not going to be through rap music, it'll be, like, in the community, in the trenches. So that's why I said I don't mind talking about my past, because it kind of connects to now. But I just had to make that decision. I'm glad I made that decision, because rap music, we all know what it is right now. We know it's not a plethora of positive material out there for young people. So I made the right decision, getting my degree and getting right into the work directly in the community.
Your dad pegged you right, that you were a social worker, and of course I know your grandmother and grandfather, as well as your mother and father, you know, both of them. And they all are socially concerned people. You know, I mean, your dad has never changed. From the first time I met him in the late 60s, he was always concerned. I would see him play. We were never particularly close. I don't claim to be in his entourage, but I did spend some time at his camp. And that's social concern. So at an age of 8, he had spotted that you wanted to help people. Tell us more about that in your calling.
He asked me what I wanted to do, and I told him what I wanted to do. So he never guided, he never put words in our mouth or told us what to do. He would ask me, "What do you want to do?" And that's what I told him. Mm-hmm. So
sometimes we parents don't listen to children, but obviously he listened and supported you in that idea. We're speaking with Mariam Ali. She is the executive director of DMTL, and she's the daughter of Muhammad Ali and Sister Khalilah Ali, and also the granddaughter of two great pioneers, former lieutenants and the Nation of Islam, and people who served as surrogate parents during my very formative years. I just saw your grandfather, 6 or 7 months ago, about a year ago at the convention, saw your mother, your grandmother. So wonderful ingredients in making family. I also knew your grandmother, your paternal grandmother and grandfather, and they all are very social concerned. I want you to talk about a little bit more about this triggering event of this young man that was killed by gang violence. He was, in fact, in the gang. And just these innocent bystanders, I think they call them mushrooms in certain parlance. Just share a little bit more about that and how you see DMTL preventing this kind of senseless violence.
Well, first of all, like I said, that was a part of my, you know, even before my cousin was killed, I was on that path of trying to be positive role model for young people with the music, and that just kind of solidified that I wanted to get into that concentration in social work, the gang prevention, youth delinquency, youth development, you know, just work in that area. So a little bit about DMTL and why it's called DMTL, which would make sense to people once I describe it. I worked as a caseworker, social worker, working one-on-one for about over 300 youth in South Los Angeles in the area that has the highest gang crime and homicide. It's called the 77th Police Division. They called it the Killing Zone back in 1999. Now they call it, you know, Death Alley. It's still the highest concentration of murders and gang crime. L.A. overall crime has gone down because in L.A. they have a comprehensive gang strategy here, which is unlike in Chicago, where many places don't have a comprehensive strategy. What a comprehensive strategy means is that they have a number of services in the highest areas of gang crime and violence. So they have gang prevention services. Gang prevention services are services for youth that are 10 to 15. Research shows that youth decide to actually commit to a gang in middle school years, between 10 to 15 years old. So that's why it's a preventative time to apply certain specific services for those people in that age group, because that's when they make that decision, I'm going to join this gang. Very few join before that age group. They're getting socialized for gang life, and then they have generational mentality of crime and violence and a lot of things going on in their lives where they're looking for a family figure and gangs to join. But the 10 to 15 year old is the prevention. So that's where I like, that's kind of where I work in that area, the 10 to 15. Then the city has gang intervention services. These are services for the young men and women who have joined a gang and they want to get out. They are prime, or they have something about their lifestyles where if you give them an alternative, they will choose the alternative if it's there. So that's intervention, intervening, trying to get these young men out of the gang and women out of the gang. And gang intervention is the foundation of that work are gang intervention workers who were gang members, many who went to jail, came out, but now they're in the community trying to clean up what they helped create, right? Because they've been there, done that, been to jail, came out, and they're really the only ones that can help, are the best people that are qualified to help talk to men and women about the gang is not the way, I've been there, done that. So that's gang intervention services. So the city has that. Across the city in L.A., they have gang intervention services in the highest areas of gang crime, and these gang intervention workers are working with these young men and women to show them an alternative. Then we work with law enforcement. And when I say work with law enforcement, and I'm giving examples. So I used to respond to gang homicides. I after doing case management, I worked at the mayor's office. The mayor's office had a gang department. And what we did was we monitored the services throughout the city. There will be a gang homicide. I will go to the scene of that homicide. I'll meet up with the gang intervention worker that works in that area. And I will liaison between the police and that gang intervention worker. So I'll ask the police, you know, what happened, which the shooting, who, when, what, why. Give that information to the gang intervention worker so he can start doing his groundwork and intel work in the community to prevent a retaliatory shooting. A lot of times when there's a shooting, there's gossip and rumors that the shooting, Pookie did it, Reggie did it, Tyrone did it, whatever. And then there's a retaliation process may start. Well, that gang intervention worker will try to intervene at the scene of the crime, talk to the opposing gang members, talk to the gang members in that area, and try to quell those rumors and stop the retaliation, which has been very effective in L.A. So Los Angeles has all these services. They deal with it from a prevention side, an intervention side, and they also have a police connection where the police will give us information so we could prevent the next gang shooting. Well, a lot of cities like Chicago don't have all these services. So DMPL, since I've been working in this field, I've seen the good and the bad, the best practices, what works, what doesn't work. My dream is to have an organization that provides services without any intervention from the federal government, the city, certain contracts that may not be appropriate, some policies that may not really resonate with the community, and make my own program that where I don't have any limitations on how I serve people. So DMTL stands for Dolores, Marcel, Tyree, and Larry. Three of these people that make up the acronym for DMTL are people who are slain. My business partner, Nason Tyree Buchanan, lived in Gary, Indiana. His mother and two brothers were all murdered. And he started DMTL. And when I met him at the mayor's office, we both worked at our Department of Gang Reduction and Youth Development at the mayor's office in L.A., we combined efforts to form a new DMTL that's going to provide gang prevention services. So that's why it's called DMTL. It's in honor of his slain mother and two brothers. So that's basically it in a nutshell. I mean, I consider myself.
You've given us more than not. You've given us a whole tree. And
okay,
I'll stop talking right now.
I'll let you talk.
I mean,
so that's basically, yeah, that's it. That's basically it.
I just think this is a wonderful thing. I just want to make a comment that the priority of this ministry are peace in the neighborhoods. There is another person, I hope he's listening, Brother Imam Arthur Farrakhan from out in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He's also been in all aspects of gang prevention and also intervention. So we appreciate both of you all, and we hope to have probably next month a sort of a summit, and we're hoping that you can tour. And I like the idea of what you're saying about developing strategies of independent of government help, independent of foundations, independent of research organizations, but best practices. I want to make that comment before asking you another question. What is it that about a young person that causes them to need to be in a gang?
Oh, wow. That's a loaded question, and it has a loaded answer. You know, young people are a part of a large system, you know, and there are many elements and dynamics in the system. So there's not one answer for that question, because youth get in the gangs for many different reasons, and there are many different factors that may draw them to a gang. So I like to talk in terms of actual stories, so I'll give you one story. So I have one kid, straight-A student, foster youth, great foster mother, beautiful home. This foster mother had a beautiful home, beautiful rooms for all her foster kids, loved her foster kids, took care of them. But this boy was an A student, honor roll, kind of nerdy, and would get beat up on his block because he was an A student. Well, we enrolled him in our program because we knew he was vulnerable because of that reason, because he was a foster youth. And even though he made straight A's, we knew he had risk factors that can put him in a gang situation. And that's exactly what happened. We worked with him for about a month and a half. This was a sad story, my saddest story. The only youth I had that actually died. We worked for him for a month and a half, about a year and a half to 2 years. He was getting beat up so much on that block, and we didn't know about this. We didn't know he was getting beat up. I wish we had known, because we probably could have helped him. And he ended up joining the gang, leaving the program, dropped his grades, and left the area. He came back to the area as a high school student, and we enrolled him in a different program for adults. He remembered all the stuff that we taught him, and he ended up coming back to do what was right. But it was a little too late. The gang members found out what he was trying to do. He actually invited some of his gang member friends to get their GED. They didn't like the direction he was trying to go back to, and ended up killing him on their gang celebration day and dumped him off into a rival gang neighborhood to make it look like the other gang did it. But they actually killed him because he was trying to get his life together. So that's one. So his reason for joining was, I'm tired of getting picked on. Then you have other people. My father, grandfather was a Crip. My father was a Blood. My whole family wears red. Then you have other people, you know, girls. I like this boy that's in the gang. So I like him. I'm attracted to him. He's cool. He's the only cool thing on the block. I'm going to date him. Now she's in the gang. Then you have, you know, my mother, father, they cuss me out. Dad's not around. Mom's not around. You know, I don't feel like I have a family. Then they join a gang. Well, all of this is impacted by poverty. These kids go to the worst schools in Los Angeles. And the poverty, of course, is impacted by disparities between certain neighborhoods, the infrastructure, the institutional segregation and foundation, you know, African-American. There are no jobs in the neighborhood. I remember this little kid goes, you know, Miss Ali, you say go get a job, but when I go to McDonald's, all the grown-ups are working in there. Remember when I was younger, high school students worked at McDonald's. Now you go to the communities and people 40, 50, and 60 are working at McDonald's. So they don't even have an environment or an economic environment where they even can have summer jobs. So what are they going to do during the summer? So you have all these many factors that contribute to gang joining. And then you have the social, the entertainment factor. That's one factor. Gangs glamorized, glorified. All the ex-gang members and the people who promoted gangs, from the Dr. Dre's to the Snoop's to the Cube's, they're all billionaires. They're millionaires. They got all kind of deals. So even their association with gangs and rapping about gangs have put them way up at the top. Now, I don't blame only the rap industry. I'm just saying there are a lot of factors that are driving these kids to go to that gang, because in the hood, the gang member is the superstar. They are. They're popular. They got money. Some of them, or they pretend like they have money. And if you're connected with a gang, you have a sense of feeling protected. You know, my friends, my cousins, you know, something happens, well, go get my brother. He's in the gang. So they yield a lot of clout in the community. So there's not one reason why people are in a gang, but someone said this to me, and I forget who said it. They said, those who get kicked out of places create their own spaces. And these young people do not feel like they're a part of anything. Their esteem is low, and they're going to create a hierarchy and create a group in a situation where they feel important. And that's the gang. That's the gang culture. So good prevention programs, good intervention programs understand all of these multiple factors, and they have services, and they have workers who know how to speak the language and know how to address all of these fears and anxieties and thought processes of these young people to try to divert them to an alternative. Okay, so you know, you have to understand all the multiple factors to be able to create the right programming. And it takes time. You know, it is not an overnight fix. Most of these kids, it took them 15, 16, 18 years to become hopeless. So you got to really be consistent and understanding and patient when you're working with them and meet them where they're at. And that's the sign of a very good program.
I tell you something. You have given us a lot of food for thought, and I'm not going to be a person that's going to crowd out the spaces or the places. I'm going to ask people to join the conversation at 805-727-7013. We're speaking with Sister Mariam Ali. She's a daughter of Muhammad Ali, but more important, she's over an organization, DMTL, out of the great city of Los Angeles. And I want her to give us her how one can contact her and how one can contribute to this great organization. And I'm going to come back and ask her more questions. And you can join the conversation at 805-727-7013. Don't be shy. I'm sure she will answer your questions. But just to give us how we can get in touch about your contact.
Okay, so DMTL, we have a website called DMTLfamily.org. It is an organization that is currently raising funding. My goal is to do a 3-year pilot project with a very specific program model. That model is pretty much in detail on the website. I'm raising money. I want to be privately funded for the first 3 years. We'll go out for all the other contracts after 3 years. However, we want to be uninterrupted to do this particular model and have it evaluated. And my dream is to train across the country on not just this model, but to learn from other models and just also train about the organizational management component of these programs. Because some programs, business-wise, are on an organizational level when it comes to employees and training and how to motivate workers to be the best that they can be with this population. To me, there is a lack of training sometimes, not all the time. You have great organizations all around this country that are doing excellent work. But this program is not open yet. I'm raising money right now. We just got our website up, so it's dmtlfamily.org. And That's what I'm focused on right now, is building the organization. So, you know, you can reach out to me. I'm not really training right now. I'm building the organization. I'm able to train, but
Are you able to accept donations right now?
Oh yeah. We're all set up on the website. And it is L.A., but I'll say this about it being in L.A. After this 3-year program, and what I love about it is that the model that's in place that we're going to do is something that I did under the city, but it's new and improved. But a lot of the different techniques and practices were very effective with the young people I worked with. That I've met them at 10, 11 years old, and now they're in their 20s, and it really was impactful. So I'm really excited, and I would bet all the money I have in the bank that this model is very effective, because I've done components of it, and if only we had city contracts that were a little bit different, I could have done exactly what I wanted to do. But after this 3-year program, I really believe it could be maybe not the whole model, because all cities and communities are slightly different, but I really believe that the results I'll be able to share with any city in Los Angeles, because there are certain things that are best practices, but I would love to share this work. So, that's what it is, and you can go on the website. I have a video of some of the youth I work with, and I just see this as, you know, I also raise money for Parkinson's research. My dad has Parkinson's. And in the medicine, you know, people ask for money to do research to cure disease, right? They've been asking for money for cancer for years. And a lot of times, you know, they may not have a cure. Maybe there is a cure we don't know about. But I know for Parkinson's, a lot of the research has gone to excellent medications, which is why my father was able to have Parkinson's for over 30 years because of the medications. And because I'm not really a medication person, but until there's a cure for Parkinson's, people cannot even live without these medications. Because if my father didn't have these medications, Parkinson's could have wiped him out a long time ago. Now, that's just my belief, because I have studied Parkinson's and I'm a part of the community, and I have seen firsthand what medications, how they've helped him. So like a medical model, we really need to look at this gang prevention and intervention thing in terms of testing models out and being very focused on that and raising money for very specific models, because you have a lot of things, you know, you have a lot of organizations, they have great models, but I would like to be a spokesperson and get out there on CNN, and if I'm going to use my last name, use it to address this issue. And so I'm just letting people know that, to know that, yes, you may be donating for an L.A.-based program, but it's a 3-year research project that can benefit other cities. And that's my goal. That's my dream. So check it out. Look at it. Assess it for yourself. You might even work at an organization where you may find something on there that's helpful for you. You could take some of the ideas. I don't care. I'm not asking money for any ideas you get from the website. Or you may have a program that you work with where you can send me something that will be helpful for my program. So it's a two-way street. I don't claim to be, you know, the only person in the world that understands how to work with youth. We have a lot of wonderful people out there that know how to work with these youth successfully. This is just my dream, because I've been doing it for 13 years, and I want to do this a certain way, in a certain manner, with no limitations, because I know from experience that a lot of city policy and contracts that guide these programs are not necessarily written by people who've done the work. My experience, there have been hospital social workers, you know, musicians, but if you ask them, have you worked in a gang prevention program before, they'll say no, but they're writing all the models. And you go, well, how can you write something up and you've never worked in that field before? So that happens a lot, you know, with a lot of the city and federal funding. You see these programs and go, this doesn't make sense. Who wrote this? So this is an opportunity for me to say, I want to create something based on 13 years of experience, 300 families, and really wanting to help the community in a very sincere way.
I just wanted to give a shout out to my daughter who was in the studio. Naima Tucker is getting her, has a BA, BSW from University of Maryland Eastern Shore. She's also will be going into MSW program, and she's interested in this kind of work. She's listening to you. She sends her greetings of assalamu alaikum to you. I want to ask you now, sister, to give us your educational background. Just tell us your educational background.
I have an educational background. I have a bachelor's in social work. Right now I'm in a master's program for organizational management because I feel there's a lot of management issues with some of the youth programs in the inner cities where they're not managed properly. Even when I worked for the city, the way employees were treated and the lack of collaboration, even at the mayor's office level, was not up to par. A lot of the do's and don'ts of organizing an office and how to deal with faculty and staff and connecting with the community and providing services that make sense, a lot of mistakes were made even at a city political level. So, nothing against masters and MSWs, but 15 years of experience, I've had to train some MSWs kind of right out of school with little experience, and I've had to train them. And with experience, they will learn a lot. But until they get that work in, someone with a bachelor's or 15 years experience can teach someone with MSW if they're just getting experience in the field. So nothing against that. I'm getting a master's degree, but I didn't want the social work. I wanted the organizational management since I have an organization, and I want to improve that aspect of it because that is just as vital. You could have a youth program, not doing best practices, people not being trained in motivational interviewing and collaborative helping and cognitive behavioral best practices and strategies, and the program is not effective because case managers aren't trained. And case managers, they usually don't make a lot of money, $28,000 to $35,000, so it's very hard to get quality if you're not investing in the training of these case managers. So that's basically my background. I just want to share that because I worked in environments where they only hire MSWs right out of school and nobody knows what they're doing because none of them had experience in the field. So I think it's really important at a very high level to make sure you have people that have some experience working along with MSWs. For MSWs that have experience work with young people that are patient and empathetic and understanding and wanting to really understand that field, you know, so that it can be tricky. I've seen a lot of mistakes being made by folks who are educated but not educated. You know what I'm saying? So
I'm forewarned of what you're saying. Naivety and sincerity are now substitute for good case management and good work. Will you accept some calls? We have two callers on. We have Garfield from New York City. Garfield from New York City, you're on the air with Sister Mariam Ali and Religion Means Alive.
Hey, good evening to everybody that's listening. Good evening to the host and to the special guest, man. Sister Peace, assalamu alaikum. How are you today?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you.
All right. I actually have a program on Blog Talk also, and we have a program called Building a Brotherhood. And every day when I'm on Monday to Friday, when I'm talking about relationships, when I'm talking about health, when I'm talking about theology, or even about finances, I have to always mention Chicago because I went to a seminar a couple weeks ago about tax liens, and it was these European guys that was leading the seminar, and they said to me, don't look at Cooks County, Chicago, because that's not good to invest in.
Okay. Hello?
Yes. Are you still there, Paula?
Yes, I'm here. Hello?
Yes.
You were in good belief. You said don't look at Cook County because it's not a good investment. Will you continue, caller?
Yeah, basically he was talking about the gang warfare that's going on there, and every day, Monday to Friday, I mention Chicago because I'm trying to put spotlight on it any way, shape, or form. And you're doing, of course, lovely work for the gangs. What would be the first thing that you would do if you were in charge of Chicago to stop all this, what's going on with the gangs?
The first thing I would do, the mayor is going to have to look at cities where comprehensive gang strategies have been effective. So I'll give you an example. In L.A., there are 16 zones they call grid zones. There's 16 zones that have been identified as having the highest gang crime.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of those zones have had a needs assessment where they're assessing in the community, from the business people to the residents to the gang members to the kids and adults, what is needed in that zone. They do thorough assessments about perceptions of the community. They're looking at gang statistics. They're looking at what people say is missing from that neighborhood based on their experience in that neighborhood. So 16 needs assessments were done. After those needs assessments were done, the city, the mayor's office, has funding through different funding resources, the federal government, Department of Justice, state resources, foundations, to fund gang intervention and gang prevention services in each of those zones. So each zone has two programs, a gang intervention program and a gang prevention program, to serve the highest risk people in that zone. Those contracts, you know how much those contracts are? The gang prevention contract was $1 million a year, and the gang intervention contract was $500,000. So we have 16 times $1.5 million.
Mm.
That is the estimate that mayor made in Los Angeles. Now, in Los Angeles, they have been doing this comprehensive strategy for over 10 years, even more. They came in different kind of forms, but they always had an intervention and prevention, I think, ever since, like, maybe the late 80s. So the reason why crime has declined, or let's just say, I won't say the reason, there's been a correlation between these kind of comprehensive services and the drop in gang crime. There could be other factors we don't know about, but the implementation of this comprehensive, so the mayor of Chicago, there are models that he knows about. He can go to the Department of Justice, has all this information on how to establish a comprehensive plan for Chicago. Chicago doesn't have that. And I don't know why, but one thing I do know is for some reason the mayor isn't investing in that kind of comprehensive strategy. And it takes a while. You got to implement it. So they would do an assessment of the highest gang crimes. You know, the police have all the hot spots where all the murders and shootings are happening. You got to put services in there because the reasons kids join gangs are not, the root causes aren't being addressed. That's poverty, that's jobs, that's services, that's mental health. It's a plethora of things. So that mayor has models across the city to grab onto and say, we're going to invest this money, we're going to go for the federal funding, we're going to go for all the kind of funding L.A. mayor went for. That mayor of Chicago has to do that and put that in place. The Safe Passage program he put in place, millions of dollars just for residents people to make sure kids get to and from school, is not enough. We have Safe Passage in L.A., I know what that is, but that's one small component of a comprehensive strategy. The mayor has to decide to do that. If he doesn't decide to do that...
Ali, can you explain to us what a Safe Passage program means?
Safe Passage program is, you know, kids trying to go home to school is dangerous, especially crossing three gang lines trying to get to school. So he invested millions of dollars. I'm forgetting how much. Was it $8 million? It was a lot of money. Where he hired, which is good, he hired residents to wear these yellow jackets and to stand outside and deter gang members from bullying kids getting to school. Well, that's a good thing, but it's not a solution to the gang problem. That's just one. We had a Safe Passage program in 10 years ago in the area of the school I worked out of, but it's a small piece of a big puzzle. It's a very small piece of a big puzzle. And unless you understand what the comprehensive strategy is, you're going to think that he's doing something. I mean, it's not enough. That Safe Passage program is not going to help drop gang crime. It's not going to address the root causes, the dysfunction, the risk factors that these people have. It's not going to create jobs for everybody. So the Chicago has to step it up. You know, Oakland has a comprehensive strategy. I mean, you can go to the Department of Justice, look up gang prevention intervention programs, and see what these strategies look like. Now, my program is just one piece as well. My concentration is how to operate an effective gang prevention program in and of itself. My organization is not a comprehensive strategy. It's a piece of it. because I you know, I've monitored all the programs in the city. I was a regional manager for the mayor's office where we gave people contracts, and we had to see if they're abiding by those contracts to get that $1 million. So I go into the agencies and see, what are you doing to are you following this contract? And I saw a lot of good stuff and a lot of bad stuff. You know, a lot of best practices, and then some agencies have no best practices. They're just doing, you know, doing things any kind of way. You know, so, you know, it's important for all of these pieces to be done correctly. But in answer, you know, the answer to your question, the mayor of Chicago has to implement something comprehensive in that city.
Mm.
Hey, it has to be comprehensive. When I say comprehensive, they got to study each area. They got to do focus groups. They have to do assessments of each area and then put the services that the community say they need in those areas.
Okay. Sister, can I ask you one quick question? Do you have a website I could go to or check you out, what you're doing?
The website is D as in Dolores, M as in Miriam, my name, T as in Tom, L as in Larry, DMTLfamily.org. That is just what
I'm putting in right now, sister. So I want to check you out right now.
My business partner is Nason Buchanan. He started DMTL when his family was slain in Gary, Indiana, and then we met at the mayor's office together, and we came together as a team to do this new program under that name. And we kept that name in honor of his family members, his mom and two brothers. So,
all right.
So I'm
on it right now, and it's programmed on my computer. You will be hearing from me. All right? Peace and love. And I appreciate it.
All right.
I appreciate you.
All right. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, brother. We have another caller from William in New Jersey.
Yes.
William, you're on the air with Religion Means Alive.
Thank you. Assalamu alaikum to you, Mary.
Assalamu alaikum, my salam.
And what I wanted to ask you was what kind of effect is the Muslim community having on the gang situation? Is there any involvement? Can you tell us something about that? And, you know, what do you think some of the things that can be done that, you know, Muslims, especially as far as being, and you know, an upright people who, you know, try to live clean lives and have some establishments like mosque in the areas, is there anything that they are doing or can be done to help with the gang violence? Thank you.
So there are a lot of masjids in L.A. There are multiple masjids in different cities. I can't answer the question as to what Muslims are doing because I'm not in all of these masjids, so I don't know what everybody is doing. I don't have an eye in all of the masjids. So I can't answer that question like that. What I will say is that we're also probably, I'm guessing, losing some of our Muslim kids, too, to this gang issue. Because in reality, Muslims have some of the same dysfunctional traits that anybody has. Whether you're Muslim or not, we all know all Muslims aren't perfect, and sometimes Muslims succumb to the same things everybody else succumbs to. So I would say in general, religious organizations and churches and temples and mosques, because this is a young phenomenon, they're going into gangs at a young age, we have to have youth programming at masjids. I go to many masjids. I went to a masjid in Denver Friday. My cousin is an imam, Imam Rahim in Denver, Colorado. You know, you go into many masjids and there are no young people there. And we have to start passing the torch and teaching them how to be imams, having youth groups at masjids. You got to give them an outlet in a social group to join. Because, mom and dad's a Muslim, you see mom and dad fasting and praying, and that's great. You know, you need that example. I had that growing up with my grandparents. It impacted me. But young people have to feel like they're part of the masjid, and you got to give them something. You got to have a youth group. You got maybe have them teach on talim or, there are a lot of masjids I go to, and this is beautiful that you have older imams. I love that. That's beautiful. But it should be more rotation of some of the younger men, you know, in their early 20s, starting to teach them how to be mams. Because when you have young men up there, you got the young men, women coming in, and you just have to diversify at these matches and give them something. Because the same thing that Muslim young person is going through at his school is the same thing a non-Muslim kid is going through. The same pressures, the same peer pressure, you know, is happening. And I've seen young Muslim grandparents lose their grandkids. And, you know, I know a grandmother in L.A., you know, her granddaughter started dating gang members, and her father was a Muslim, and she's a Muslim, and she lost her granddaughter to this culture. So if we don't have things in these masjids for young people, if you don't have a young program, if the imam, if they're not young imams coming in there teaching, grooming these young men to be imams and having sister circles or whatever you need to have, you're going to lose our young Muslim kids a lot of the times. You know, all these kids are not going to be perfect kids in this kind of society we live in. So I would say if you're part of a masjid, bring that to the table if it's not already there. And I, you know, in communities that do have a lot for young people, you'll see those young people thrive and stay out of all this American mess. And they have a high self-esteem and about their religion and about their faith and their community. But you got to give them outlets in the arts, poetry, whatever it is. Ask young people, what do you want to do with the masjid? What do you want to see? Ask them. Don't tell them. You ask them what they want. And it's really important to look at models, because I'm sure there are masjids that are doing really good with young people. Call those masjids and get that information and find out how you can duplicate things that are working for young people. So that's how I would answer the questions in terms of the, you know, there are a lot of masjids that do a lot of work. They feed the homeless, you know, they mentor. I just can't answer the question for all Muslims because I don't know what everybody's doing.
I like that answer, and you are 100% right, Whitney. That's what we have been doing here at Religion Means a Lot. We have two young people we're looking for young people to host the show. That's what we're looking for. So all you got to do is write us Imam Alfred at Gmail. We want to plan programs. We need youth programs. One of the secrets to Mr. Farrar's growth, he had baseball teams, basketball teams. I remember as a young man in the Nation of Islam, your grandfather was a lieutenant. And under that, we didn't have to have those problems, at least those people in my age group. I'd come in the Nation when I was a young person. I would have gone to a gang or some type of organization. But I got my life form inside of the community. So I agree with you 1,000%. One of the things I want to ask you about, because there are several cities that we're targeting as you build your organization, we want you to come to, and that is Philadelphia and Newark. Both are plagued by second generational Muslim youth. And I go into I don't visit prisons anymore, but I used to with the work in prison. I've seen our children in the jails. So I don't think Muslim being Muslim without a program is any panacea at all. It's just the beginning. So could you speak to that? Because there's another group out in Chicago, I believe, is the Interrupters. Jeff Ford's daughter is heading that organization up, and I mean, they're Muslims. So, I mean, there are a lot of Muslims there, and I agree with you. Muslims do not guarantee you that you don't have a problem. Just means that you are a human being and you will have problems. So I don't know whether I should further ask you to comment on that.
There's macro solutions like mayors of cities, you know, and how we're connected to that is voting. You know what I'm saying? You know, the percentage of, you know, we voted in an African-American president. You know, white folks did it, Asian people did it, Americans did that. And I used to always bother me when people say, I don't vote because the system doesn't work. I just, you know, I don't think politics is all that great. I think there is a lot of corruption. But when you take yourself, when you are a population that is showing the political, you know, powers that be that you don't care who's voted in office, then they love that. You know, and so my people couldn't vote. You know what I'm saying? They could not vote because of slavery, and there was laws against. I go to the polls every time just because of that alone. Whether it works or not, I'm going to look into who's who, because there are policies. There are people that are for and against certain policies. There are judges that are for and against certain policies. There are district attorneys and prosecutors and city council people that are for and against certain policies. We have to do a better job of knowing who these people are and keeping them out of office. And when you say, I'm just not going to vote, then you just, guess what? We're not getting South L.A., we're not giving this area Detroit, because they don't even show up to the polls. We're not going to put any resources there. They don't even vote. If you show politicians that you can keep get them out of office, you're all of a sudden you're going to see policies and resources for our community, because they'll say this community votes. And so, I mean, you know, yes, there's a macro solution. Then you have a micro solution at a smallest level where the family, the community, you know, the mother, the father, you know, the mother and the father, let me tell you, has the biggest impact on these kids. If you could just start in your house with how you're talking to your kids, if you're cussing them out, if things are not working, go online and look at some parenting skills. Don't be bigger. Your ego should not be so big that you should think that you can't learn how to be a better parent. Even though you think you're a better parent, if you're bumping heads with your daughter, go educate yourself. Put yourself in the class, because there are some things that you don't know about. A lot of parents think they do things right and they're not doing stuff right. Telling a man not to cry. Not allowing a young person to express what they want to be in life. Not listening to them. Not getting involved in who their friends are and talking to them after school. How's it going? What's going on? You got to talk to these kids. They're people. They're little bitty people with issues. If they may say, so-and-so happened in school, Mom, oh, don't worry about that. You shouldn't even be wasting your time on that. Well, your kid is trying to tell you about something that really matters to him or her. Listen to them and take that seriously. Because they're at a stage of development where what's serious to them and important to them is different than you, but it's incumbent upon you as a parent to make that important to you, too, because that's where they're going to go wrong. If they're a little fast, friend, tell them and talk to them in detail. And they're, you know, like, I got a little daughter and she got a little fast friend, but her friend will talk to her about all her issues, but I won't as a mother. She's going to follow her little fast friend. She's not going to follow me. So if you're having issues with your child, don't just say, oh, they just at that rebellious stage. No, you need to figure out how to deal with that rebellious stage. Because, yes, you might have some conflict because they're adolescents, but if you're having a real hard time and you're losing your child, you need to try to figure some things out and go online, go to a class or go to a counselor, whatever you need to do, because we're not all perfect parents. Parenting is the hardest thing you could ever do.
That's 1,000% right. Let me bear witness to that 7 times. And I make mistakes. I have children from 42 to 13, and I tell you, sister, it's a job. Right. And there's no manual for it. That's the problem.
Right. As great as my father is, he made mistakes. He made mistakes. But I had a grandmother and a grandfather, and then, you know, because I would check my dad all the time. Me and him would get into it. Like, I'd be saying, so his daddy, that's not right. I was one of them kind of kids that would check him on his stuff, right? That was just my personality. You know, so we can learn as parents. I mean, I made mistakes as a case manager dealing with parents. I said, oh, man, I didn't say that right. I learned from that. 13, 15 years in the field, you're going to make mistakes. You know, so we have to humble ourselves to know, no matter how old we are, there's something new we can learn about anything. I don't care if you had 10 kids.
Well, let me ask you this. Is a part of the prevention program is that parent education. Because it seems to me,
God,
you know, a lot of families, you know what, the surprise of me in working with you is that you find families that are supposed to be middle class, they got the 2-car garage, they got the whole bit, and now children sometimes are the biggest precursors to gangs and prison populations.
Right. Yes,
will you comment on that?
The program is definitely a family-centered model. It's definitely family-centered. We don't work with youth in silos and in isolation. It is a family affair.
I don't want to be a laugh and have a comedic day, but I like that you don't work with them in silos. You work with them in environment, right?
Well, you have to work. You have to address the whole family. You really do. You got to address the mother, the sister, the uncle that's living there, the grandmother. You have to really, your eye has to be open and your ears have to be open to that whole environment of a young person. Because they can be perfect in your program and go home and everything you did is undone.
So you have to
find, and they're ways, they're little clever ways to try to penetrate their family and build a rapport where they will listen. I've had parents where they didn't want to deal with me for a whole year. And they observed me for a whole year before they would say, I'm going to talk to this woman on a certain level and actually listen to her. Some of them wouldn't even listen, and they can't go to jail, come back, and then they call me then. You know, Miss Ali, you told me this was going to happen. And I may hear from them a year later. Some of them just are vibing out my energy, saying, can I trust this woman? She's a social worker. She might report me. She might this. And so I got to act a certain way and talk to them a certain way and be consistent in a certain way and offer my help in a certain way to know that I can be trusted. So there's a lot of training that these caseworkers need. You know, I see some caseworkers, they're just cussing the families out and telling them what to do, telling them they're parenting wrong. You can't talk to people like that. You have to talk to them in a way and work with them in a way that respects their decisions and try as much as you can to pull from them their own solution. And there is a certain way of doing that. It's a collaborative process when you're working with families and getting them to see what the solution is based on what they want, what their vision is. You can't say, okay, parent, do ABC, because what you're doing, 1, 2, 3, is not working, so you have to do ABC. You cannot deal with parents in the community on that level because they're going to resist every time you're telling them what to do. You have to get that information to them and pull it out through them. And then that's just a whole training that needs to happen with a lot of case managers. A lot of folks don't know how to do that. I didn't even know how to do it the first 2 years that I did this work. I had to learn how to do that. You know, and that's something that people in school, they don't even teach you how to do that. It's a strength-based model, and you might know in theory, but until you're on the ground doing it, to know how to apply it takes a lot of practice to apply that, to get the hardest families that don't want to listen to nothing to pay a little bit of attention to you and see that they're the reason their kid is going wrong. Hello?
I had it on mute. I really want to ask you this question, but I'm going to ask you this question. Your father and your mother both a people person. Did that help influence you to give you the skills to, and your grandfather was very skilled at working with people and dealing even with strangers. Did that affect you in how to gain rapport and help you as being a social worker?
I would say yes. I mean, I believe in DNA, the genetic factor. I definitely have a lot of my parents' genes. I think that I'm a communicator by nature. Most of my siblings are communicators. So I definitely think your parents and your environment and, my religion has been unbelievable, had an unbelievable impact on me. I always think about things from an Islamic perspective when I'm making my decisions. This is right. Should I be doing this? Should I not be doing this? I'm not saying I'm perfect, but that is a factor when I'm making decisions. Is this the right thing to do on an Islamic level? So I'll say yes, that had an impact. But
I mean, you processed it and you did work with yourself. I mean, obviously, you know, there's a lot of people, a person is a Muslim and they think automatically this happens. One has to make a choice and one has to process this. And, a lot of Muslims that seem like they think it's like magic and there's no work involved. Well, I'm going to shut up and ask, we have a caller from Providence, Rhode Island. Caller, you're on the air with Sister Mariam Ali. Yes, caller.
Yes, assalamu alaikum. Thank you,
Imam. Alaikum assalam, the singer of the national anthem. I hope you'll be on tomorrow to sing it.
Inshallah. Yes, I want to just contribute to the conversation a little bit.
Yes, sir.
Remember, Alfred, here's the way what I like to contribute to this, is that I see that we have already had a whole generation of our youngsters that have been desensitized. And they've been desensitized, Imam Alfred, to the point where in our time, in our generation, if somebody's head was cut off, that would shock us to death. That would have shocked us to death. We would have been petrified. But this generation, will actually take that head and put it on a pole. They don't have any feeling for that head that fell off, that head that got cut off. And that's mainly due to the type of entertainment that they get from the video games. I'm putting it point blank. They see so much of these Transformers and live demonstrations of people being murdered, people getting their arms and heads and legs cut off over and over and over and over again, Imam Alfred, to the point to where our children, our 17, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, they can shoot each other, kill each other, and they will not have any remorse whatsoever. They can shoot. They can be shooting at each other and shoot an innocent little baby. They don't care about that baby being dead. They've been totally desensitized. Here's what I fear. There's another generation coming up. I look at my grandchildren wrestling. Why are they wrestling so much? And I go in the room over there, and I see that they're watching these games. These robots and stuff fighting each other, killing each other. They got swords, and they cutting each other's arms off. And doing these kids are wrestling, and you think they're just playing. They're actually acting out what they've seen, what they're watching. I'm telling you, right now, it's good. I love everything the sister said about trying to help these people and try to make them see that we can't do this. We can't keep killing each other like this. But I'm telling you, you are fighting an uphill battle on that one because they've already been desensitized. We better take our focus now. We better take our focus now and put it on the new generation coming up. I also found out that most of these video games that are displaying this on TV and DVDs and everything, there's only a handful of people behind that. There's only one man that thought of it, and he got three or four assistants, and they're able to put it on from Hollywood or whatever, and put it on the TV and affect millions and millions of people. And they only got a handful of people. But each one of them that put on these things, there's only a little small handful of people behind them. We let them come on with this. We let them put this on the air, and we're fighting the problem. I mean, we're not getting to the essence of the problem. We're only putting a Band-Aid on what we see. Coming out of our children. This is what we see. We see all this violence. But we're trying to help them. We're trying to stop them. Hey, don't do this. Don't do this. I tell you right now.
Billy, ma'am, can you direct your question or comment to Sister Mariam Ali? She's doing that. If you have a question or comment for her, because we have
okay, two right, well, you know, you know, Buddy, ma'am?
Yes, sir.
Even the Lifeline asked me that same question. And I tell them, I always address problems. I always address problems, you know, for everybody to hear, you know? So that's just my nature of how I talk and how I bring things forward.
Yes, sir.
And I appreciate everything the sister's saying. Believe me when I say it, when I tell you, at least I know there's some warriors out there. Listen, that sister's a warrior, and I love her. I love it. And I hope, well, I wish we had more like that, more like this, that's trying to help these young people, you know? So keep up the good work, my dear sister. I'm sorry, I didn't get the name. I'm sorry. Could you mention?
This is Mariam Ali, the daughter of Muhammad Ali, and she this sister is doing a very fine work. EMTL family organization.
There's nobody that I know that gave me more inspiration for what I do than Muhammad Ali. He made me a brave man. He gave me courage. I'm telling you, it was Muhammad Ali. That had the biggest effect on my life since Walid bin Muhammad himself.
MMTL. I'm sorry. MMTL family.
No, it's D. 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 M. T. L.
What did I write down right? My head is DMTL. I'm sorry. Please forgive me.
I'm going to finish up. And everyone's going to take one, not even a minute. So what I'm saying to you is, what I'm saying that. You muted me? Hello?
Yeah.
Did you mute me?
No.
Oh, okay. What I'm saying is we got to get the government from all cities and all states and the upper government. They got to turn their attention to Hollywood and these people that are putting out these things, because we have to put that out so that it doesn't continue. Because if we just let these video games go, just let these things go, our next generation is going to do the same thing. And they might even be worse. Because now I'm starting to see them disrespect their own parents. Never mind shooting somebody outside. They're starting to kill their own parents. So this is something that we have to go to the core of it. That's all I'm saying. We got to go to the core of it, and that is making sure it doesn't come over the airways to affect our children. So thank you, sister. I want you to know that I want you to keep up the good work. We love what you're doing. Inshallah. Thank you, Imam Alpha, for giving me this time.
Assalamu
alaikum.
Thank you. So I believe entertainment is one of many factors. I don't believe it's the core of all factors. So I disagree a little bit with that. I do think it's bad. I do think it desensitizes. But I don't think it makes all kids murderers, because if you look at the statistics of the crime, the young people who commit crime, the gang youth and the violent youth, when you look at all youth population, the actual shooters and the murderers and the people who would be desensitized enough to chop off a head, is less than 1%. So that's just the numbers. But I do believe there has to be a movement to stop. It doesn't make it any better. It does desensitize kids to a point. So you could have a kid who, then you go back to the parenting. How young are they getting these video games? Are the parents exposing them and just leaving them at home looking at the video games? It goes back to parenting again. You have kids who were brought up with those video games. I have a couple cousins. Their honors, they just graduated from college with honors, and they played every death mutilation game in the book, and they're sweet as they could be because they had parents. And so I believe it's one of many pieces, but when you look at the numbers of how many kids, you know, when you got to watch, you got to be careful of the news, because the news will have you thinking all kids are murderers, but if you look at the statistics, a very small percentage of kids are that cold-blooded. So you have to watch what you think is going on and look at the stats of how many kids are actually committing heinous crimes with or without a video game. And that's just the facts. So I disagree that video games is the core of the problem. Statistics tell you otherwise. You have to look at everything. Because if you have parents thinking it's only the video games, they're going to think they don't have to be the parents. If you got people thinking it's only... So in terms of video games, again... There are policies in place that allow kids to be able to buy these games. If we're not active in government, if we're not voting people in and out, and we're not advocates where we understand how to reverse these policies, they're never going to go away. So in trying to get rid of those video games, we have to figure out how do we advocate for getting these video games out of the hands of kids where, you know, maybe only adults can have them, but not kids. That's one thing. The second thing is you have to be a better parent. You shouldn't even be buying your kids these video games. You should be monitoring them watching these video games. So I will say again, look at within your circle of influence. Look within your circle of power and do what you can do at your level. Be a better parent. Find out how to go against these video games being on the air. You know, there's just so many reasons why kids are going astray, but the reality is there's a small percentage of kids who are actually cold-blooded enough to kill. Even in gang groups, when you look at gangs, less than 1% of the gang members are actual shooters. Most of them are too scared to shoot and do the drive-by. It's like 1% of all the gang members will actually be bold enough to do that. So when we're making decisions and when we're making statements, it's really important to do a little research and look at the actual statistics so we don't have people so fearful where they really think the majority of kids will cut somebody's head off, because that's not true.
Sister, I know you got about 3 more minutes. I know you have to be gone. I'm going to ask you to give us a closing statement and then ask you if you come back next month this time. We'll be in touch with you to continue this. We got a lot we want to talk about. We want to talk about some more and more about your organization. Give us your email, your website, and any other information you'd like to give us. And
the closing statement will be, you know, if anybody who has a computer in their house, look at your parenting. Listen to your kids better. Understand that you can always learn You can always learn something new. Don't have the kind of ego where you are not looking to improve yourself. That'd be number one. So look within your own household. You know, are you a person who's single, 30, no kids, but you have some nephews you can mentor? Are you just kind of self-consumed and you got all these nephews, maybe they don't have fathers at home? The first thing I would do is, if I had a little kid I'm working with a single mom, that says, well, who are the men in this family that can help you? So if you care about this issue, try to figure out what it is you can do to be better or to help somebody young and be an example and a role model for them, number one. Number two, I think people need to be active in who is representing their state. I think they should do some study on, you know, our boys are going to jail, our girls are going to jail, minorities are going to jail. Who is the prosecutor when the voting happens? When those cards come in and they're saying so-and-so is running for the prosecuting attorney, you know, it can be a person that's being voted in, or you're not voting at all, that love putting our people in jail. We have to get involved in the system, whether we like the system or not, because I will tell you, there are databases that are in operation checking and seeing that you don't care about your community. And if you don't care about your community, resources aren't coming to your community. That's hook, line, sinker, that's bottom line. If we start to be active and edgy and stop living outside of this structure that we're living in, we have to be informed. So on a policy level, on a governmental level, start educating yourself about who's running your state. And if you think it's just hopeless and nothing you do is going to help, then you're never going to see any change. If a black president, you know, existing is not enough for you to understand that we can get involved into this political system by using our vote and using our head, I don't know what else is going to convince you. So I would say on the political government state level, know what's going on in your area. Join your neighborhood watch, your neighborhood or their neighborhood organizations. Get involved and be, you know, a force to be reckoned with. And also looking right within your own family. Because if every family took care of each other, we would see a change right away. Just if every family took care of each other. It doesn't have to be this complex thing. So get involved politically. Know who's running your city, your township, your state, your council, and get involved with your family members. And know that you are never too old to learn to be better. Whether it's a father, a sister, a daughter, or uncle, you can learn at your age, at 50, at 60. You can be better than what you're going to be, what you are. You know, you can be a perfect person, a great person, but you can be a little better. So I'm always educating myself. Learning is never ending. You know, in the Quran, you know, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said, read, write. You know, that's just not the Quran. It's read everything. Read anything that can enhance your life as a Muslim. You know, so, and as a human being, as a citizen, as an American, read, understand. Don't be so stubborn and stuck in your way where you don't want to educate yourself. And that's what I would say in closing.
All right, now, just give us your website, and I know you're off to another busy meeting as a great humanitarian and one of our great heavyweight champions of social change and social development. You have the passion and the commitment. So leave us with that, the name of your organization.
The website is D is in Dolores. And the D stands for Dolores. DM is in Marcel. The M stands for Marcel. T is in Tyree. L is in Larry. DMTLFamily.org. That's my organization that I'm building, that I'm raising funds for. You can email me through that. You can just see what I'm doing, working on. If you want to contribute, that's fine. If you want to find out the organizations in your area and see what they need and contribute to them, that's fine. It's not all about my organization. My message is be a part of your community and be really involved in your family and be a better parent, be a better role model. Even though you think you're good, be a better one. So
I'm going to tell you, you got a job. We're going to invite you back to Religion Means Alive, and we're going to actually ask you to speak for us on a Sunday. Well, we have public lectures every Sunday at 3 o'clock. So I hope you will listen to us tomorrow. We're going to pick out a lot what you talked about today and bring it out to the general public. Thank you, Sister Mariam Ali, who has spoken so eloquently and so forcefully for the uplift of humanity and the prevention of gang life and the prevention of murder, and that you are so consistent with the theme of Religion Means Alive, which is the first goal of Religion Means Alive, is peace in the neighborhood. Thank you, dear sister, and assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam. Thank you for having me.
We've had a conversation with Sister Mariam Ali, and as Howard Cosell would say, we're going to go back to the video and kind of have a discussion on her discussion. And if you wish to join the conversation, you can just press 1 on your phone, and we're going to tease out some of these issues that you talked about. We have a sister coming, calling from... sister, you're on the air.
This is Brother Muhammad Mubarak from Fort Myers.
Brother Muhammad Mubarak from Savannah, Georgia. Yes, sir. One of our ardent supporters. Stuck with us through thick and thin, cold weather and warm weather. Yes, sir, brother.
Okay, well, I want to say, you know, the sister's right on point, and my heart is so happy to know that our great champion has produced a daughter just like herself, with courage, outspoken, a freedom fighter, and a voice for his people, because she's speaking the language of Imam W.D. Muhammad.
That's
coming down from his father, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and that wisdom of her grandmother to have a son like Muhammad Ali and knew how to deal with a man. We need more strong females like Mariam Ali, and like she said, we need strong men, mentors. We're going up to this farm in Fort Valley to try to establish that, where we can invite you to come work that farm. And that's the direction that the Imam pointed, New Africa and Fort Valley. That's where we're going. But I want to say that sister talked about so many things that's in our best interest, that those that are supposed to be in the association of the Imam, we need to get busy with that. Getting these young men, putting them to work, finding some recreation and programs. And the way to get those videos out of their hands is to get that language of Imam W.D. Muhammad into their hands and live this religion, not just talking. We got to have recreation and activities. We got to have programs, entertainment, so they don't have to go outside of us. And we have to establish this. We can't just talk about it. Sister Mariam Muhammad is right on point. And like I said, my heart is so happy to know that our great champion produced a daughter like that. And I pray, Allah, she continue and she influence and encourage other females as well as men to respect her knowledge and her wisdom. And I want to say that I wanted her to know before she got off that her father is one of my greatest heroes, along with the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, W.D. Muhammad.
Yes, sir.
Because whether his condition is or whatever, he's the greatest fighter and the greatest, one of our greatest of all time, to help the African American, first and foremost, but also representing humanity. He was a good human being in the totality, because he never abandoned the leadership of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and as great as he became, he never abandoned the leader of W.D. Muhammad. And that should make the rest of these other so-called Imams that think they're great, they're just tiny compared to Muhammad Ali. And he never abandoned Imam Muhammad. He never betrayed Elijah Muhammad. He stayed, of course, a true supporter to their language. So, thank you, brother. I just wanted to express that.
Well, I thank you, and let me tell you something. I know every month that you all gonna talk the talk. I know I'm gonna receive a check for you. We thank you for supporting Religion Means Alive. I have some more tapes I'm gonna send out to you, because you all are regular supporters. I love you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, you and your family. Thank you, my dear brother.
that. We love you too, brother. And as soon as we get up for a band and things get better, we're going to send more. We're going to send
you.
More.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you and love you and your family. Peace.
Yes, bro. We look forward to y'all coming to visit us there.
We will. We send us an invitation the next time we're going to come down and visit you. Thank you.
Right, thank you. Yes, sir.
We have a caller from Atlanta, Georgia. Caller, the midnight train or the midday trip to Georgia is on the air.
As-salamu-alaikum.
Walaikum as-salam.
Hey, this is Brother Amir Muhammad, modern-day prince from out of Atlanta.
Yes, sir. Well, we love modern-day Prince. Let's hear from the modern-day Prince. What does the modern-day Prince from his phone have to say?
I just missed her, actually. Miriam was one of me and my brothers and sisters' babysitters growing up in Los Angeles. Our families are close. So I just missed her. But I just wanted to, let her know that anything she got going on, we support her. We support her down here from Atlanta. And I know they support her back in Los Angeles. And definitely will.
Well, that's right. You are the Amir the filmmaker. That's right.
Yeah.
Okay, you hiding in the gut. Oh, Amir the filmmaker. Yes.
You know I'm listening.
You're part of the national tour. You're going to be doing our videos. We're going to tour the United States of America. We're not going to stop. After we tour the 2,000 by 3,000 mile land called America, then we're going to go down into the Caribbean, and we're going to go from Rio de Janeiro all the way up to Halifax, Nova Scotia. We're coming after the African people here in the Western Hemisphere to wake them up and put them back on our post that has been taken away from them.
Well, I'm right there with that. That's what I'm...
I know we're going to stop in DR, PR, everywhere else. Wherever our people are, they need this message of wake up. Let them know that the heavyweight champions of the globe is on the throne. Imam W.D. Muhammad, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, we haven't given up any of that work. We are going to continue that work, and we see the generations continuing. Myra and Mali is a heavyweight champion of development. We're not going to stop. I was just at one of the historical black colleges. We're going to see them revived. We're going to rebuild the African-American community. I want to tell you something that Dr. Elijah Muhammad said. He said within 3 years after he's gone, he said we're going to lose everything. And we lost everything but our mind. We lost our material life. But he said when we come back, we're going to get it all back. And we'll never
lose
it again. And that's what I'm saying.
And I believe that.
Filmmakers, everything we ever desired, our heart desired. We're not talking about no 10,000 years from now. All you graduates and scared people, buckle up your boots, get on your horse, and let's ride on into the destiny.
Well, Imam Afwood, that I just released a map of Imam W.D. Muhammad's community. And I released it. And it's always going to constantly be updated, because if it's not updated, that means we're not doing anything.
Right. Will you please tell us how we can get that map?
Right now it's on social media. I might have even posted it on your page. If they go to your page, I think it's on your page as well.
Tell them how you can go to my page.
Well, if you go to Facebook and you type in the search engine at the top that's on Facebook and type in Imam Alfred, you should be connected with him in some kind of way with a lot of friends that his name should
pop
up.
Our social media expert has just created another site for me called Religion Means Alive. We even have a group. So we're going to hang out together. We're going to be the Religion Means Alive gang within the community of Imam W.D. Muhammad. That's going to be our little squad, our little committee, and we're going to work as hard. We point out the we're going all the way to the Super Bowl.
I'm with it. Let's
all right, you with it?
You
with it and ain't going to quit it. We're going to build schools. We're going to build businesses. We're going to build cultural centers. We're going to build government right in our life. And not like our African-American Christian music says, soon and very soon.
I said soon and very soon. But we're going to see it, not right now, but right now.
Yeah. Anybody else like to join the conversation? We have about 7 more minutes. 805-727-7013. 805-727-7013. Yes, Brother Amir. Anybody else like to join the conversation? See you coming, calling from Florida. See you calling from Pennsylvania. Wherever you're calling from. You're calling from Brazil. We're on the air. Are we? Okay. So thank you, dear beloved people. Any more callers? Continue, Brother Amir, to another person call. We got 7 more minutes.
Okay. Well, what we got going on, we actually also have a music video that Alhamdulillah, I went to crowdfunding sources on the internet, and they gave people donated enough, and the donation, it really was not a surprise to me where the donations came from, just as far as where Imam Muhammad's really where I say the bread and butter areas are for the community. I got donations from out of the New York, New Jersey area, Philly area, Chicago, even Moscares donated from Los Angeles and from Atlanta. And those are major cities that really have a lot of supporters of Imam Muhammad and really see us as still a family and a community. And when I put out the map, the music video is, the map is going to be seen in that music video as well as our flag and showing our connection with not only America, but
will
also
you explain to our audience what crowdfunding is? What does it mean to have crowdfunding? Because
it's when you have different sources. You can go to Kickstarter. You have Indiegogo, iFundy. There's different websites that you go to, and really you can do it. But I mean, from the street, this is not nothing new. It's just been done. Being done on the internet where you make a video of what you're trying to do, what your goal is, what product you're selling, what product you're trying to put out, and you're trying to raise the funds for those. So depending on what you're trying to do, you know, people who have a vested interest in what you're trying to do, they go on and they can donate towards it. And you have a goal in mind, and so your goal, say your goal is $1,000. These crowdfunding internet sites, you send people there by posting it through social media, sending it through email, and they go there, they see what your project is about, and if they like it, they'll donate towards it. And it's public, so anybody can donate, even if, you know, they just happen upon your page. And in some scenarios, if you don't reach the $1,000, send all the money back to all the donators. In other scenarios, as soon as they donate, no matter what you get, you can raise $400, $500, and they will send you that towards your project. But the contributors are contributing so that you can actually do what you said you want to do or that you aim to do. So even if you don't get it, even if you don't reach your goal, but you still take their money, then they should see what their money went towards. And so you'll send them emails, gifts, different things like that. It can be a lot of different things. They can be the first people to see your video when you finish or whatever works. You can invite them out at the opening of whatever it is. But people donate towards that. And a lot of times, you know, if you have enough supporters, you get it, and that's the way you get your jump start. And so with mine was a music video, and I had already completed the song, so I let people know that that's what I was doing. I let them hear the song. The entire song is at the end of when I finish speaking, they see the songs and they see the lyrics playing on the screen to the song while the song is playing. So people who identify with the song, because this particular song was about is specifically trying to get, because I know that it's there. It's already there. We just haven't tapped into it because I'm in the university system. It's trying to get Imam Muhammad's community noticed and get us as te- as teachers in the university and college system teaching English, because what's happening is the universities are seeing that we live in a global market, and a lot of their countries do not like Westerners teaching the people of their country, but they will send students here. And when they send students here, and it's not just because of that, but, you know, they have good, United States has good relationships with a lot of different countries. And so they send a lot of their students here to go to our universities. And what you find is a lot of these students are in all the classes that I filmed just in the last year alone, 80 to 85% of the students were all Muslim. And I said, well, why? And I'm looking at, and I'm filming these classes, and I start seeing things that the teachers are doing that they don't mean to do this on purpose. It's not on purpose, but they do things in ways that somebody, if there was an indigenous Muslim here, which Imam Muhammad's community is, they would know not to teach them the kids or put an emphasis on that. So say they're teaching them about animals, and they're real, and I've seen this, teachers really excited, and they like a pig. And you could see in 90% of the class is turned off by just that statement. And so I'm looking like, man, if she was Muslim or if she knew, she would know better than to do that. And even when they put groups together, you can see that when they mix the males and the females, a lot of these foreign students are not used to that at all, and they're thrown off and they're put in uncomfortable situations. And so when I saw that, I'm like, you know, our community will be perfect for this because we've been here the whole time. America knows we're not an enemy to America. And as well, it would build those relationships so when foreigners come here, they can at least think in their mind, the African-Americans that they see or the portrayal of African-Americans that they see on television, which is the only portrayal that they know, which is a standoffish. Nobody would want to be around African-Americans if you saw the way that they depict us on television. Only, and that was your only experience with African-Americans, if we're teaching them, we also come with most of our family, we got 50% of our family or more Christian. So when you have both sides like that, when questions come up and those students are really trying to figure out how to navigate America, who's the best in America at doing that? Our community, no doubt. So that's what the song is about, and it's actually... it's putting that to the forefront to be visible. And so what we're coming from, what's coming out of that is where there's a video, and then we're opening a company at the same time so that at the end of the video, you see, they will see who to contact. And so what we're going to do is vet people from out of our community that already have the credentials, the degrees, and the experience of teaching English classes, and get them jobs. The goal is to get $1 million worth of jobs in the university and college system for members of Imam Waqf Deen Muhammad's community. And I know we do it because I'm in the university system, and I see it, and I know that it's there. And they would be happy to have our group be a part of that. It's a win-win on both sides. So we just haven't done it yet. And so that's what the song is about.
We thank you, Brother Amir. We thank our noble and honorable listeners. I have a very special address tomorrow. I'm going to be addressing the role of culture in formulating society. This is my first day back on the public address in 3 weeks. I feel really empowered by Almighty God. I got a very, very special message. I'm going to incorporate a lot of what Sister Maria Mali has given us. And we're going to talk about how to develop a culture of winning. That's our message. Create a culture of winning in our lives. Our lives have been, since we've been in America, someone said, I don't have any luck but bad luck. Well, I don't believe that, but we've had some trials. We've had some knockdowns. We had some drag outs, but we kept on getting back up. So we're going to talk about how to infuse our lives with a culture of winning, creating the winning culture of success. We're going to beat down the Snoop Doggy Lion. We're going to beat down all the forces of Stagger Lee, and we're going to beat back the Reinhardt. We're going to beat back the Donald Sterling. We're going to turn him back into a Donald Duck. But we're going to wake up our people
and move them to the finish line. So tomorrow I have a very special address. I was really empowered by listening to a speech yesterday by John Lewis. And John Lewis told a story when he met Nelson Mandela. He wanted to introduce himself to Nelson Mandela. He said, "Mr. Mandela, I am John Lewis, and I want to tell you who I am." He said, "Look, John Lewis, I don't need an introduction of you. I know who you are. I've been inspired by you." And that's what has happened throughout the world. People have struggled for that human dignity, and they have been inspired by the African American. We're going to inspire more people. We're going to bring the world to the destiny that God has intended for us, for the world. I want to let you know that the 18th, 19th, and 20th of July, a week before I was born, I'm going to be giving a very special presentation at the Ramadan session at Mosque Cares in Chicago, Illinois. Look it up, Mosque Cares. I have the address. 929 West 100 and I think 71st Street in the city of Hazelcrest, Illinois. We're going to be giving a very special address there. And my address will be the theme for this year's Ramadan session is the Quran, a guidance for all people. My address, the Quran, my subtopic will be the Quran and the establishment of community life and destiny and the establishment of new Africa and inspiration for all people. As God says in the Quran, "Come to Kharitan, Ummatu Ukrijat Lunas." He has raised you up for the service of all people. So, Pete, I'm fired up, Sister Mariam Ali. Knocked all the ignorance out of me. Knocked all the lethargy out of me. Knocked the tiredness out of me. And put me solid back into the ring of light where we are ready to battle. Peace be on our noble and honorable listening audience. Until next time at 3 o'clock tomorrow, you have listened to another edition of Religion Means a Lie.